Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Steve McHenry took his O-levels up to Filton, aged 16, at the end of the heyday of British aviation, and worked there as an engineer. He tells his tales. And Anton Chaitkin, he is talking about deindustrialisation of the United States and Britain and the coming catastrophe. He asks the question, well, I ask him, who's in charge, the Brits or the Americans? Or neither? Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you've got someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready, please, at the end of the show.
My name is Stephen McHenry. I'm Bristolian born. I come from a village called Winterbourne. I went to the Riding High School, or it was a secondary modern when I first started. Then it turned to a high school when we were in our third year. And then I left at the age of 16 and a bit with my trusty O-levels under my belt, and was accepted into British Aerospace as a technician apprentice. When I actually joined, I think it was in the back end of it was still British Aircraft Corporation prior to it turning to BAE, as it were, then British Aerospace. And it was a massive behemoth. It covered virtually the whole of Filton, and all the way down Filton Road, joining up with across the other side of the runway with Rolls Royce. It was a massive setup.
So you say it's a massive setup. Were there different factory units producing different bits of aeroplanes, or what was going on?
Very much so. The factory was split into many individual little engineering facilities in their own right. It had its own foundry, where it did some smelting and foundry work through to, God, there were so many departments. There was an aircraft fitting and redux department. There was a plating facilities, press works, an engineering shop where they had CNC lathes. And it was just sprawling across the factory, and every aircraft component was made individually at the factory. It was as an apprentice. Once I'd finished the first 12 months in the basic training workshops at Rolls Royce Technical College, where they took us through, milling and grinding and drilling and all sorts of air engine fitting and learning all the various engineering type skills that would be required to go into the actual factories and eventually specialise at the end of your apprenticeship. Touring the factory then, we were sort of seconded a month at a time, sometimes 2 months, sometimes a couple of weeks, to various manufacturing departments throughout the factory to learn that basic process and get a feel for it. So overall, by the time your apprenticeship finished, you had this kind of really well-rounded and grounded engineering background. When I first started, I'm going from memory, I think I was on £11 a week as an apprentice when I first started. But each year, as each year progressed, you were guaranteed certain pay increases and inflationary increases. The whole thing was very much unionized then, so unions were very strong. They still had power back then in the 70s before the onset of Maggie Thatcher and all that good stuff and the breakup of the unions. People at the time were wondering where the next project was coming from. We were working on BAE 146, which was a sort of a small passenger airline. I think it was the Queen's aircraft. It flew the Queen around for quite a considerable time. That was basically keeping things going. Then they turned a little military, and the American F-111 had a modification done on the cockpit, which was it wasn't an ejector seat as such in that aircraft. The whole cockpit ejected, and there was a pyrotechnic conversion that they did on the F-111. I worked a little bit on that. And then, of course, the they converted the in-flight refueling tanker, which was the VC-10, which was another old passenger airline that they built many years prior, and they converted into in-flight refueling tanker. So that kind of kept the whole thing going. This was prior to Airbus, of course, but people were kind of wondering where the future lay, and there were some nervous times, and there were some layoffs and shortages.
Did the Americans support the Concorde project, and did they have anything to do with it, grinding to a halt eventually?
Oh, very much so. No, they didn't support it at all, Tony. I think, the outset of Concorde, well, I think the French did 001 and Bristol did 002, and then they were rolled out and used as a kind of a marketing tool to go out into the world and get orders. And they had, I think, originally over 100 options to take up these orders. And things were looking very rosy, even though the aircraft was very much, very expensive. I think I'm going from memory, something like $25 million each at the time, which, in 1970s was an astronomical sum. But shortly thereafter, things started to go wrong quickly, and the Americans, the noise and the ecologists were saying about pollution. The engines were such that they were polluting the atmosphere, the sound barrier, the sonic boom was going to be a massive problem. And really, they painted a very bleak picture of Concorde, which led to the cancellation of quite a few of those options. And eventually, it was basically down to the French and the British who took up those options. And what was it, 14 or so aircraft that eventually went into service. I think at the time, the Americans were jealous in that they had their own supersonic project, which they wanted to compete, as it were. But I think their costs went off the scale, and they ended up scrapping their own project. But it was enough at the time to cast a lot of a lot of doubt and a lot of bad press against Concorde.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hi, this is Anton Chaitkin, and I'm in Virginia, USA. I'm an American historian. I'm a longtime political activist and writer. I did a couple of books, one called Treason in America from Aaron Burr to Averill Harriman. The other was George Bush, the Unauthorized Biography, about the father, Bush Sr., president. I was a history editor for Lyndon LaRouche's magazine, Executive Intelligence Review, and one of the founders of his movement back in 1966.
So as a political activist, do you ever feel like you've been banging your head against a brick wall, Anton?
No. I think that the world that we started being activists in required us to take steps because the strategy had changed. And I think that the strategy now that they changed it to, it has come to an end. It's a dead end. After the Kennedy murder in 63, his killers drastically changed the strategy of the Western world to a system that is unsustainable. The program became to deindustrialize the United States and the UK, to impose austerity, to loot and cripple the third world, and to prevent the rise of powerful nations.
But I mean, what I'm saying is, you must surely feel, I mean, as many people do, that the political activism is not really worked and that things are actually getting worse.
Well, actually, there has been for quite some time now a counter movement that will involve the United States, or the United States will help bring the world to a catastrophe. China and Russia today represent the original American values. And what my contribution, which makes me very optimistic, is that I'm bringing the light of history to that original American mission.
But look, before you go into any detail there, I've got to say, I mean, China has got no real free speech at all. So where are the American values in China?
Well, what are the American values? That's where the current concepts in Europe and UK and USA about American history and about what those values were is totally wrong. All of the industrial and scientific progress of the West was caused by strategies of the idealists, the Republicans, the people who wanted to uplift mankind. No industries were started or developed by the imperialists, by the Wall Street and London axis. They never contributed anything. They tried to stop at various times the progress of our society. I'm not just talking about high wages. I'm talking about actual industries and inventions. They never promoted those. Those were done by their opponents. Even in the English Industrial Revolution, that was true at the very beginning. That was done by Republicans who were friends of Benjamin Franklin. In the United States, what we have lost sight of because of environmentalism and various other prejudices, some of them just simply anti-U.S. prejudices, we've lost sight of the complete strategy change of the United States itself. The original mission was to bring about rapid industrial progress in the USA and globally. That was the idea. And that was put through after being aborted in the original, right after the American Revolution, when Hamilton's program was not allowed to go through because of the intervention of the British Secret Service and Jefferson and the worst of the slave owners. But it did take effect in the second generation. The nationalists, the humane nationalists in the 1820s and later under Lincoln in the second phase brought about the industrialization of the United States. Further progress was done in industry and science later on by Franklin Roosevelt and under John Kennedy. And that is the source of most of the Western world's progress. It was those initiatives to have the government promote industry and promote very, very radical breakthroughs in science, such as bringing electricity to the public. These were projects like the railroads. They were, for example, the first American railroads, all 60 of the first railroads, were designed by Army engineers that had been assigned by the government. Private companies were subsidized by the government. Canals in the same way, by government action.
But I mean, the cynical might say, Anton, about, for example, yeah, you know, we're just around the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 and the first steps on the moon, that actually, you know, this was one way of looking at it. You could see one side of the coin. This is just, we're just doing it because we want to do it, and it's because it's difficult. That's what President Kennedy said. But on the other side, there was surely an angle in which this kind of technology, once developed, could be used to militarily dominate space. And so some of this, does seem to have a kind of military advantage, an empire side to it, even though on the surface of it, it's something which is being done for the betterment of humanity.
That's right. Well, I'll point out the title of the book I'm writing. It's called American Prometheus, Progress versus Empire from Franklin to Kennedy. Prometheus represented those among mankind who wanted to help human beings get the use of the most advanced concepts in the universe, to discover the secrets of the universe, even against the will of the oligarchs. And so if you look at any of these breakthroughs, they of course could be used for ill or for the benefit of mankind. The first inventions, the steam engine, modern steel making, precise machinery that were developed in England in the 1770s and 80s were done by those who wanted to uplift mankind. At that point, the empire, the city of London, especially people like Lord Shelburne and Pitt, said, all right, now the empire can use these advances, which at that time were causing higher wages, we can use these advances for the benefit of the empire, and we will act to prevent any other country from getting this kind of power over nature. They later developed a political slant, which we call today radical environmentalism, and generally pessimistic philosophy that comes directly from the Anglo-Dutch royal family, earlier the Venetians, some of the Romans, and so forth. This is the imperial idea that man is just a pile of garbage and is not divine in his nature. But our side, the Republican side, the idea that those who wanted to uplift mankind are the ones to whom you have to give the credit for developing every step of progress that mankind has done. So if we can acquaint the public with what has been done in the past and who's responsible for that, we can spark a revolution in thinking. The space program, for example, is ready to take off with the United States participation. Right now, it's being done by China, it's being done by India, it's being done by others. But I am sure that the great majority of the American public would back a very, very vigorous space program. The only thing standing in the way is the very narrow control of public opinion that's really, to me, is breaking down for a feudalism outlook and for wars and so forth. That's a media concoction. The public doesn't support that program. The public does not really support going backwards into the dark ages. They would support the space program. They would support an upgrading of the culture of the United States. For example, getting out of the failed educational system.
So, I mean, for most people now, looking at the United States, they're not really, obviously, there is very little of space program, even though they've got military satellites and things like that in space, and Trump has talked about a space force.
No space program now.
But what people do see is an almost obsession by the US, and it has to be said, Britain too, in intervening in the Middle East, which has caused so much hardship. What is the British role, and how far does it go back in the creation of the State of Israel? Because as many pointed out, you know, it's not the first time we've had a kind of crusade in that part of the world with people from Europe trying to basically create a fortress in the Middle East from which they can spread their influence. So how far does the British role in that go back, Anton?
Well, I would prefer to look at the 1922 Sykes-Picot Treaty that set up a lot of this nonsense and the Balfour Declaration and others that set up this the British intervention in the Middle East. I would prefer to put that in the context of every location that the British Empire and similar empires, particularly the British, carried out the same strategy, which is to put put religions and ethnic groups into warfare against each other in order to reduce their mental capabilities.
Okay, so can you give us some examples of how they were doing that?
Well, India and Pakistan, the Hindus and Muslims were put against each other by the British. In Ireland, the Catholics and the Protestants were put against each other by continual British intervention. In the Middle East, even at the point after World War II, when Jews were going to Palestine, there was still a chance that you could set up a Palestinian state with both religions, or actually three religions, being part of that without it being an exclusively Jewish state. And you had factions in the West. This is the crucial thing. The issue is here in the West. It's not in any of those locations where the religions fight against each other to their mutual doom. The issue is here in the city of London, here in Wall Street, here in Washington. The question is, for the interest of the United States and Western society, you have to have a shutting down of this warfare. That's our interest. That's our material interest. So when you have this kind of perpetual warfare concept, no matter what the excuse is, and people, I think, foolishly get involved on one side or another of these conflicts. But the conflicts are created in London and then in New York. That's where it comes from. The problem is not in any of those locations. The people act foolishly in those places. They act viciously, like they did in other places, South Africa and so forth.
Well, it sounds almost like you're talking about the old adage of divide and rule.
Yeah, that's right. but what's missing from people's conception of solutions is a picture of how we ran things when we were successful, which we're not successful now. Kennedy, for example, President Kennedy proposed using nuclear power plants for desalting the water all over the world. He changed the International Atomic Energy Agency to set up a real strong initiative of the USA and Russia, together with Israel and Arab states, together with Mexico, together with other large countries, to set up nuclear desalinization. He wanted to have the full cycle of nuclear power. And this idea of cooperation between the United States and Russia primarily was always, way before Kennedy, the national idea of the United States. It goes back to the American Revolution. It went back to our revolution. It went back to our Civil War when we were allied with Russia. It went back to FDR. And then it was taken up again by Kennedy. But that idea of the cooperation of the great powers is an integral part of the American mission when we broke with the British Empire to establish a successful nation.
Okay, I mean, many people here are a bit confused in Britain about the American Civil War. I'd be interested to get your assessment as to, I mean, there's all sorts of causes are put forward. Things like the attempt by the North to get slavery abolished by the Union. And, I mean, there's also the idea to get rid of independence for the individual states and to centralise power in Washington. So what do you think were the main changes that came out of the war and the motives behind it?
We had, when Lincoln was a young man in the 1820s and 30s, we had progress when the nationalists were in power in the United States, and they promoted the progress of the entire population. They were anti-slavery. And then those people in the South, the slave owners, together with certain Wall Street interests, who were all connected to the city of London and who had never approved of American independence, overturned the progress, the government initiatives to bring about railroads, canals, industries. And for about 20 or 30 years before our Civil War, the worst of the slave owners, together with Wall Street, dominated the United States for the benefit of the city of London primarily. Most of the cotton went to England for the mills where they paid very little wages. So when finally this broke up in 1860, when the North was strong enough to put Lincoln in power, who was a protectionist, a nationalist, and a universal thinker who knew what the problem was of imperialism imposing backwardness all over the world. And so he put through a program of massive industrial progress that made the United States the greatest power in the world. This caused inventions, a whole combination of high tariffs, government credit, scientific initiatives of all kinds, gave us public electricity, which was shared with other countries, gave us transcontinental railroads. The Russians then did the same thing with some American help. The Russians actually helped us in our Civil War by sending their navy to New York and San Francisco to warn the British and French off of bringing imperial forces to aid the southern slave owners.
Well, I also point out, I mean, I'm talking to you from Bristol, which is where John Cabot sailed from, so-called discovered. Obviously, the Native Americans had already discovered North America by the time he turned up in 1497. But there was also financial interest from our city through the merchant venturers who had been very much involved over the centuries, really, and still own much of Bristol, own much of the city. So we've got people here. It's not just the City of London, Anton. But look, I mean, I'm also fascinated by the way that the British and the United States have kept this kind of relationship. They call it a special relationship. Who do you think is in the driving seat between Britain and the United States these days?
Actually, all of our history involves a clash between the London-centered oligarchy. Really, it might be said to be Anglo-Dutch, and those nationalists in the United States and their allies in other countries, some of them in England at times. But all throughout our history, we've had this clash between the Republic and the Empire. Wall Street came to be a satellite and then a partner of the City of London. But now we have an offshore system, which is based not in any country and is not for the benefit of any nation. This system represents pure criminality. They launder the funds for drug mafias. They are looking to prevent the development of stability in any part of the world. I would ask people to go onto my website and read the 6 chapters of the book, which have been put online for free, of the book that's in progress, American Prometheus. It's AntonChaitkin.com, and you can go there and read what's already been written and the plan for the rest of it.
Yeah, but you haven't answered my question. Who's wearing the trousers between Britain and America these days?
That's in question. That's a contest.
I mean, also, the other question, of course, is you're talking about an oligarchy. Who are these people? Name some names.
You have to go back to, in our history, go back to a change in the oligarchy in England that took place around the time of the American Revolution when Lord Shelburne, the Marquess of Lansdowne, brought about a coup in England. He was briefly prime minister, but his way of acting and his use of new intelligence services, new covert action, like destabilizing France and bringing about anarchism there, this was the new oligarchy running the British Empire. And the purposes of the empire became more and more concentrated in this kind of destabilization of civilization. Even while the nationalists in different countries were building up the power of nations. So the oligarchy was located in the royal family, in the Privy Council, in the Bank of England, in a location in Geneva, Switzerland, a particular set of bankers there, in Netherlands. But this is an international point of view that goes back to the Venetians and before them the Romans, and even before then to places in the Middle East. This oligarchy, it's more identified not only as a group of families, but as a point of view that longs for a return to the period before the Christianization of Europe, before the nation state, before the Renaissance, when the landed lords and the bankers, to some extent, even then, had absolute power. There were no nations and no real laws. So when you're talking about this oligarchy, you're talking about definite institutions. For example, in England, there is no government that is separate from private institutions. It's all one blob. It has come to be the case in many respects in the United States, but it's against our Constitution and it's against the success of our country.
But I'm sure British politicians would disagree with you, Anton. They'll say, well, we actually do what we want. You know, we are an independent political party or whatever. You know, they will say, yes, these are powerful people lobby us, but we then decide whether or not to do what they want.
Well, sometimes that's the case, but then you have the intervention of assassinations, you have MI6 or MI5 or whatever it is, and other agencies, even outside the country, being used to destroy politicians that deviate. But what the public misses is that this all depends on the public itself being demoralized. When there is leadership, as we had in the United States at certain times, such as in the recent memory, Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy. And before that, a couple of times in our history, not only was there great progress made, and this also occurred in other places like in under Bismarck in Germany and so forth. But whenever you have this kind of leadership, the public expression of intelligence, of thinking, of an emotion beyond self-interest and beyond greed makes progress unstoppable by this criminal.
It sounds
oligarch.
To me as if, you know, you're saying that the present day governments in Britain and America and most of the rest of Europe probably are spreading apathy, that they actually feed off of it.
Yeah, exactly. They spread demoralization. And one important part of that is horrible culture with bad music, with narcotics, with bad art, with despicable education, with attacks on the concept of industrial and scientific progress.
So what do they hope to gain from that?
Well, they have, in one sense, it's just naked power. Take what happened in Africa. After the nominal independence of African countries at the end of World War II, Wall Street and London, the city of London in particular, instituted measures to keep Africa from becoming strong, modern nations. President Kennedy helped the president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah, to build a great hydroelectric dam to help industrialize West Africa. Kennedy was murdered, and Nkrumah was overthrown by a coup that was set up by the military in London. What was the benefit to Britain? No, there was no benefit to Britain. There was no benefit to anybody except those who say that a small criminal oligarchy operating offshore should dominate the world without interference by a strong large population nations of all kinds. This world would be a lot safer if it were a multipolar world with many modern and powerful nations all possessing the secrets of nature, including nuclear science
now,
and fusion.
What about,
and space.
What about, I know you've written quite a bit about eugenics over the years, and I would like to get your take on designer babies, because that's something that's happening now in Britain and in the United States, something that maybe even 20, 30 years ago people said was an aberration and impossible. It's now beginning to happen. So where do you think eugenics is at these days?
Well, I would warn people that if you rely on the aristocracy, which includes the royal family, to design your babies through their programs like eugenics, look what happened to the royal family itself. Do we all want to be like them, horse-faced and so forth and mad? But the policy of eugenics, euthanasia, Darwinism, where they took the facts of dinosaurs and the facts of millions of years of development and twisted the facts to say that the reason species developed was because the species and nature imitated the British Empire, kill the weak. This was insane. The dispute was not whether or not there had been changes in species.
I mean, we think now, don't we, of eugenics as being associated with Nazi Germany, but where did it actually begin?
It did begin really in ancient society with the oligarchy, but this has been revived in modern times with Malthus and the followers of the later 19th century British oligarchy that was trying to change. It's not simply the action of eugenics. It's the point of view that says to the public that man has no higher calling. The mind, there's no soul in man. There's only superior man and inferior man. So there was a whole set of pessimistic philosophy of this sort that came up in the 19th century in England and then in the United States, particularly in the southern states, the slavery tradition, to try to counter. This was a strategy, a deliberate strategy, to try to counter the super optimistic success of the Americans, the Germans, the Japanese, the Russians, and others in the 19th century who were bursting out of backwardness by promoting modern times. People were getting electricity and power and knowledge all over the world, new chemistry, and plans to soar and to bring mankind into a high living standard all over the world, and more important, to give people all over the world the ambition to be truly human and not to be degraded by living as a peasant under an oligarchy.
What about modern European Union? Because this is something which really began after the Second World War. Some people say actually even before that. But it's now at a sort of a crisis point. And there are, it seems, more people, individual people who live in many of the EU countries like Italy and Greece and Britain, who apparently want to leave. And as that's happening, so there is seems to be more centralisation of power in Brussels, which I suppose is one of the main reasons why people are wanting to leave the EU in the first place. So what's your take on what's happening with the EU right now, and how long can it last?
It's clear that there's been a revolt for several years in Western Europe and United States against this kind of globalism that's represented by the dictatorship in Brussels.
Hang on. You call it a dictatorship. We've just had a new elected government of Europe, a president of Europe, Ursula von der Leyen.
And what's her program? And does the public in Europe promote that? Do they agree with it?
Well, they didn't actually vote for her because it was only the heads of government that were allowed to vote for her.
And who appointed the heads of government to vote for that? I mean, this is a farce. The problem there is, again, looking at the history of the republic and the nation state versus the empire. The idea of this kind of centralized power over Europe as opposed to nations, really started for the 20th century, right after World War I, when Montague Norman and a guy named Arthur Salter, who was an economist inside the League of Nations, but particularly was the Bank of England, started up fascism, first in Austria, then in Italy, and then in Germany. And the idea was that you're going to have a centralized control, anti-labor, anti-national control, an imperium that doesn't look like it's run from these London bankers, but is something that will crush out the aspirations of the European nations to imitate the progress that's been done in countries, that most recently countries like Germany, Japan, Russia, and the United States. So this was a counteraction, this fascist movement, and the promotion of World War I and then the promotion of Hitler to bring about World War II. This was done by the London Wall Street axis. The World War II was, if World War I was entirely a London affair, the United States was dragged into it. But the European Union, it was never a progressive idea. What we needed after World War II, and we could have had, was a continuation of the alliance of the United States, Russia, China, and other countries. Those countries would undergo changes. There's no doubt about it. Britain would undergo changes. But there were positive elements in all those countries that could have continued the cooperation of World War II and brought about a modern world and actually saved civilization from the danger that it now faces. I would go back to the aims of Kennedy before he was murdered, and look at that as the aims of the Western world, which have been now turned around and shut down in an unsustainable system.
So how long can the European Union last? Do you think it'll last a long time? Is it going to, because it's doing its best to, you know, Brussels to take more control as people seem to be wanting to leave. And I just wonder where you think that particular one is heading.
It's clear that the future and the desire of the majority of mankind for this future is in the great projects, including the space program, including nuclear and fusion energy, including high-speed rail. China is pushing this all over the world. Russia would like to do it. They're financially strapped. by the system, really, that's globalism. But the globalist system itself has to be fracturing because it's unsustainable. There's profit without productivity. There's no production underlying it. It's all looting. And so there are laws of nature in economics. So the future belongs to those who are going to improve the power and capabilities and scientific skills of the population, and who have an idea that large human populations who are skilled can do anything positively. They can accomplish what would seem like miracles. That's the future. There is no other future. There's no possible future of a small group of people who believe in feudalism continuing to grind the world down in narcotics and perpetual war. It simply won't work.
I mean, you've used this word feudalism quite a few times to describe it. I mean, you know, that I don't think many people would recognize the modern world as a feudal world. Well, where do you think the, you know, how do you justify that? Because, you know, you seem to be implying that the, you know, election process, the mass media is a bit of a sham.
If you look at the mass refugees and mass, not just the migrations, but diseases, the failure of whole sections of the planet, what's the cause of that? The cause is this system of perpetual war, the intervention for regime change, the rules of the IMF that forbid industrialization, that forbid technology transfer. So that feudalism, under feudalism, it wasn't simply a peasant that knew nothing outside of his village or his farm, didn't have anything. Feudalism was also a system of plunder and wars where there was no law and there was only the welfare of a few in certain places. And it was an unsustainable system that was imposed. That wasn't the ancient system. This was something that was imposed inside of Europe. And it was a doomed system from the very beginning. Mankind could have gone down to extinction if that had spread all over the world. Now we have globalism. Do we really want that to follow this failing globalism into a nuclear war between the United States and, or UK, Anglo-Americans, and Russia? I don't think that's a good idea. I think that you go back to the coup against Kennedy again, where he intervened to stop what would have almost certainly have been an extermination nuclear war. We are under the rule of these oligarchs. We are now headed in that direction. At the same time, we're headed in an opposite direction with China's Belt and Road proposal, which is open to USA and Britain to join.
Well, the United States seems to be doing everything it can, probably the Brits too, to stop that. But look, I know you're from Jewish extraction. Can you just give us your take on what's happening in the Middle East with Likud and Netanyahu and the, you know, the what they call the Zionist entity in many parts of the Middle East, but we know as the Israeli state? They seem to be wanting to have a war with Iran and doing everything they can to strong arm the United States into that, you know, doing various provocations like getting Trump to say that the Golan Heights are actually part of Israeli territory and this sort of thing. And it doesn't really seem to be any sort of slowing down of Netanyahu and the Likud's push for having some sort of confrontation with Tehran.
Well, the Jewish people within Europe played a very valuable role, that is the educated ones, of being a certain kind of outsider who could offer an insight into the values of civilization, which kept them alive within Europe. The problem for them and others like them would be when they tried to adapt to the oligarchs in order to seek protection or power. And so you have this insane gang that's arisen, and including a large section of the population in Israel, with orthodoxy and with a whole set of underground connections to the military and strategic establishment in for the Anglo-Americans. This connection is fatal for any kind of solution that is for the benefit of the people of that region, including Israel. I was over there in the early 1960s, and I saw in Israel a kind of racialism that grew up in that society from that connection with the Anglo-American oligarchy. It's a very striking thing that people in the West are really not seeing in a very good way. If you think that this kind of attitude of, say, the oppression of the Palestinians is something that is endemic to the Jewish people, or that this is the same thing with the Muslims, about that whatever attitudes are negative are endemic to the Muslims, this is something that you're missing. There is a very exposable history of the most profoundly evil controls within Israel by an international axis that runs from primarily historically from the city of London and from the crown, not for the benefit of the Jews in that region or anywhere else. And it's certainly true that the same forces in the city of London that put Hitler into power also backed the development of this insane attitude and aggression that's come out of the State of Israel in the recent period.
Now, look, Zionism and Nazism have been compared by a lot of people, Anton. I mean, there's quite a few people out there pointing out that the apartheid system now imposed by the Israeli state on the Palestinians, people talk about it almost as concentration camps that the people are in. Do you think it's actually anti-Semitic, or do you think it's absolutely unacceptable for people to be making comparisons between the Nazis and the more extreme Zionists represented by Netanyahu?
Well, you can have a laugh at some of this, because if you examine the attacks against Mr. Corbyn, Labour Party leader, on this account that his faction is anti-Semitic, these attacks emanate from institutions and billionaires associated with the city of London and the offshore system. I've looked into this quite a bit. And you have the same kind of thing that goes back to the original problem in the 1930s. My father, Jacob Chaitkin, was the legal director and strategist for the boycott against Nazi Germany carried out by the American Jewish Congress and the American Federation of Labor. This boycott against Hitler was before Hitler had really a big army to start a war, but he was in power. And that boycott was opposed by the leading Jewish bank in Wall Street, the Kuhn Loeb, and their organization, the American Jewish Committee. They were intensely loyal to the British system and to the international system that at that time was promoting Hitler and Mussolini. And they held press conferences in New York to denounce the boycott against Hitler Germany. That was in 1933. My father was an FDR Democrat. And thank God we had FDR to stand up to Wall Street and to force Churchill. Churchill and the British stood up to bombing. But Churchill and his faction wanted to keep the war going on forever. They didn't want to overthrow Hitlerism. They wanted to have a war that would be perpetual. And we finally were able to invade France, and together with the Russians and with the bravery of the forces, including the British and everybody else that was on our side, and the Chinese, we won that war. But the war continued after that. I don't think World War II was ever concluded. That's the problem. We've got to bring that to an end and go and simply say that the alliance that we had in World War II to fight fascism should be resumed and enhanced. We should have the friendship between the great powers, all the great powers, to preserve civilization and take it further. Civilization is worth saving, despite radical environmentalism, despite whatever atheistic doctrines can be brought up now. Civilization is precious, and it's something we ought to acquaint our children with and work with the between the great powers to solve our problems, including solving things like terrorism. We don't need wars to do that. The wars are causing the terrorism, not solving them. We need, for example, you want to solve the ISIS problem, have the great powers send their troops into the banks in Saudi Arabia and London and shut down the bank accounts, shut down the drug supply for the people on amphetamines carrying out these terrorist operations in Syria. We have no real enemies of nations. No nation is our enemy. Iran, North Korea, Russia, China, all the ones that are talked about in Washington or that Washington is pushed to go against from London. It's insane that all the nations have the same interest, and that is to have a future with an industry, science, and high skills and high wages that come from those things.
Now, Anton, can I just ask you just to remind us about your books if people are interested in reading some of your work?
You can go on my website. It's Anton Chaitkin, AntonChaitkin, AntonChaitkin.com. The book that I'm writing now is, the first section of it is online with accessible for free to the public. It'll be published probably by the end of the year and sold. But I have a lot of other articles online. One that you might find interesting was called The Coup, Then and Now, C-O-U-P. And that's on, just put that title in, and my name, Chaitkin, and you can Google it. It goes through the coup against President Kennedy, which the culmination of which was his assassination. But it shows this Secret Service combination across the Atlantic that had always been opposed to the development of Western ideas and Western progress.
Now, you mentioned in your talk just there that one of the objects of the oligarchy is to try and convince humanity that, you know, we're just kind of almost like robots with no soul. Can I just ask you, because that's an interesting point to make, about your own faith and your own spirituality?
I think that what we do as creative persons expresses the Creator's work. And is we learn about the Creator by studying science and by doing good in the world. We learn what that's all about. We're never going to know it completely, but I have complete faith that that's who we are, that we are made in that image, the image of creative work. And the beauty that we find when we see the harmony in the universe by doing science, by using reason, that beauty is reflected in human actions that have caused all the progress. So when I'm given a chance to fight for progress, it makes me happy. And that's true about all the greatest artists and scientists and musicians and statesmen in every country. I think you'll enjoy the book that I'm writing, especially the first chapter, which is about England and the great progress that was launched there in the 1700s by very, very good people. That reflects among the typical leader of this kind of progress in society, that reflects in their mind a faith in God and in which whose nature we don't really know, but the character of goodness in that notion is what gives us a chance to have a decent existence as human beings.
Anton Chaitkin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Steve McHenry and Anton Chaitkin. That's C-H-A-I-T-K-I-N, Anton Chaitkin. Also, our studio engineers, Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you've got some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday, midday, from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
I started feeling funny. They said, you ain't got a house, you ain't got a plot, I ain't got a window and I ain't got a job. But it takes a lot of blue back to satisfy my heart. If I could get my hands on some F-old money. Well, I went to the social just to get a little pension. Distress, I was needing some attention. They said, you don't get a car if I don't get a damn. That's why I broke your jaw, that's why I'm doing time. But it takes a lot of blue backs to satisfy my heart. If I could get my hands on some F-old money. My lawyer in the city, he said, you're gonna come and see me. Boy, it really is a pity. Those savings you got in the casino disappeared. And he went out the window real quick, honey. And I'll do it all again, but it may sound funny if I could get my hands on some F-old money. Get my hands on some F-old money. Well, I went to my bank just to raise a little money. They said, I'm glad to see it, but I started feeling funny. They said, you ain't got a house, you ain't got a job, I ain't got a window and I ain't got a plot. It takes a lot of blue backs to satisfy my honey. I could get my hands on some F-old money. F-old money. F-old money.